I should. So it's kind of fitting because we'll be looking at Esther and comparing her to another woman, but actually comparing to much more than that. And let's just start with some prayer. Lord, thank you for today. Thank you for the promise of rain. Pray that you would bring it down. And thank you for bringing us all here together. And I ask that you'd show us new and exciting things from our time here. And bless our discussion. In Jesus' name. Amen. All right. So, we all know what exciting holiday is coming up.
Right.
Of Purim. And so we're going to be doing the next two Bible studies based on Esther. And Esther is just a repository of allusions. The way it's written refers back to so many other stories in the Bible. It's actually astounding. The person writing down the story of Esther lives after the exile. So he has basically most of the Bible at his disposal. And I don't know about everybody in here, but when you come at reading the Bible, I think we're all a little bit, I don't know what the word is, I'll just say lazier. We depend a lot more on a written Bible. We depend on concordances. But if you've been hearing these stories again and again and again, you actually start to memorize them. And you actually pay very close attention to the way things are worded. Because part of the message is how it's said, because it's going to link back to how other things are said. And so I want to look at some of those little links to help us get more as we read Esther, like we're supposed to read every year. And the great thing about Esther is there's always something more to get. As I said, it's really astounding in that sense. And it's wonderful, like all good literature, all levels can appreciate it, because my little kid who's 5 can read the book and appreciate the plot and make noise when bad Haman comes out. And then for adults and for people who read and reread, you get more and more. So, in fact, there's so much that I had wondered which links to follow, because there's so many. But I'll just say it now. If you're interested, on Wednesday night, I'm going to do a lecture at Christ Church, is Wednesday, the 12th of March. And it's titled something about the good, the bad, the ugly. And we're going to follow the links of Amalek and Esther, which, of course, if we were all good Jews, that's kind of obvious. But it's nice to go back and spell out where all those links are coming from in the text itself, and what you can glean from it.
That's at Christ Church?
That's at Christ Church, yeah.
In competition with the Robin Mark.
Yeah, big competition.
I didn't book it. I was asked by David Pelegi, who then is out of the country. Have a seat. So I won't blame you if you don't come. It's okay. But that will be looking at the link to Amalek. So today I want to look at Esther, and I'll just say where I'm coming from. Recently I've been reading a book, actually a nice article by a guy named Yitzhak Berger, and he wants to show the connections with Esther and the whole Benjamite royalty, which is basically Saul, the first king. And that can be surprising to some of us, because I think we only think about Saul as negative. But actually there are positive things about it. And there are people who were interested in showing those positive angles. Just as David, right? David is the man after God's own heart, and he's the ideal king, and la 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 la. But he has negative things in his life as well that we can learn from. And so sometimes you can compare and contrast to show how some of the things in David's style of ruling weren't ideal. And of course, not everything given to us in the Bible is to emulate. Some things are given to us to specifically not emulate, including David's life. So first, the comparison isn't something we're imposing on the text. It comes straight from the text. Look at Esther 2:5. Anyone want to read it quick?
Now there was in the citadel of Susa a Jew of the tribe of Benjamin named Mordecai, son of Yair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, who had been carried into exile from Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. Among those taken captive were Jehoiakim, king of Judah.
Okay, no, that's good. So, we have a little lineage. And who are they introducing here? Mordechai, yeah. Let me just scroll back. Okay, so. Hold on. I'm trying to get my spelling right here. 2:5, there we are. So I'm going to write down the names there really quick. And then someone can also flip over to 1 Samuel 9:1. Like to read that.
I will. There was a Benjamite, a man of standing, whose name was Kish, son of Abiel, son of Zeror, the son of Becherath, the son of Abia of Benjamin.
Okay. So you hear a similarity in the introduction? There was a man, and then they give several of the generations, and they end with Ish Yemini, a Benjamite. So this one is Mordecai. And this one is Kish. Okay, so notice you have a similar structure. You have a Benjamite being introduced. In 1 Samuel 9, it's Kish who's introduced with this. And so in Esther, it's Mordecai. And why do I draw attention to this? Because this is all to give an introduction to Mordecai, but the real introduction is coming in the same way that the real introduction in Samuel is coming. And who is going to be introduced in Samuel?
Saul.
Saul, the first king. And so who's going to be introduced in Esther?
Esther.
Very good. We have one vocal person here. So, the parallel that these connections are trying to set you up for is to see Esther in light of Saul. You're making a comparison. She's a queen, he's a king. And this is interesting to me because a lot of people make this parallel. And there's validity to a lot because in the book of Esther you have kind of a dual hero-ship, you could say. The main character is split. But in the same way that they're introduced, it actually, the literary links are lining you up to make a parallel between Esther and Saul. And this is a parallel that has been caught within Judaism as well, as you closely read the text. Now, let's think about Esther. What do we know about Esther? What's she like?
She
She's beautiful.
She's beautiful. How do we know that? Read me a verse.
Was lovely in form and features.
Okay. What verse are you reading?
Small print here. I think it's 7.
Of chapter 2?
2.
There we go. Yifat toar v'tovat mar'eh. Okay. So two ways of saying she's beautiful. Let's put very beautiful. And what do we know about Saul?
He's hot.
He's hot. Oh, sorry. Let's do that. Also, very beautiful, if you were to
handsome,
speak Hebrew.
Handsome.
No
one among the Israelites more handsome than he was. He stood head and shoulders above all the people.
There you go. No one more handsome than he was. What verse is that?
1-2. What? Excuse me.
Chapter 9.
Chapter
9.
Right? Samuel 1.
First, 1 Samuel 9.
9-2.
Sorry. There you go. This is 2-7?
Yeah.
Okay. So now are that. Not only are they very beautiful, but basically no one can compare. And Saul, in his case, is head and shoulders above everyone else. I hope Esther wasn't head and shoulders above. Because that's not usually... Well, I won't go there. So, in the same context of being both good looking, also look at 1 Samuel 10:24. Someone read that out.
Samuel said to all the people, "Do you see the man the Lord has chosen? There is no one like him among all the people." Then the people shouted, "Long live the king."
Okay. Do you see him? There is no one like him among all the people. Again, it's kind of like he is it.
Exceptional.
He is exceptional. He's exceptionally, and this is all something they can see, right? So he's exceptionally good looking. Now, look at Esther 2:15-17. What do we have?
When the term came for Esther, the young woman Mordecai had adopted, the daughter of his uncle Abihail, to go to the king, she asked her nothing other than what Haggai, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the harem, suggested. And Esther won the favor of everyone who saw her.
There you go.
Enough?
Yeah. That last line. Again, it's everyone who saw her. So everyone who saw Saul thought he was just the best thing. And everyone who saw Esther, you know, liked her. Okay, so we know they're both good looking, exceptionally so. And what do we know about their character? Character is sometimes harder because it's not given to you explicitly. It's not going to say something like...
Shorter because she must have been strong and able to do something. Strong character, one thing.
Okay.
She's daring. She's
daring.
Does she start off daring is my question.
No, I think she's rather an obedient little girl.
She's quite obedient and kind of reserved until about chapter 4.
And that's her strength. I mean, that's what she's supposed to be as a good little girl.
Exactly. So if you look in chapter 2 of Esther, verses 10 and 11... What do we read there?
Esther had not revealed her nationality and family background because Mordecai had forbidden her to do so. Every day he walked back and forth near the courtyard of the harem to find out how Esther was and what was happening to her.
Okay, so at this point, Esther is still very much obedient to Mordecai, her adopted caretaker. And so she's kept her lineage a secret. She's not been in your face about it. It's very, she's very reserved, basically. And if you notice the verse we read before, she did everything that Haggai told her. Remember, every woman could choose something to go into the king with. And she didn't even initiate in that. She just, oh, what do you think? Okay, we'll do that. So she's, the picture of her is very reserved at this point and very obedient.
And I, later on, that obedience then, you can say that it causes her then not to perhaps have that on her own, because...
To perhaps not do what?
Not, she hasn't had the opportunity to express herself. All at this point is just obedience, because then when Mordecai says this is happening, and she says, you know, you can only go to him if you, if he calls for you.
Right,
you know.
Right.
But she's also a woman that is spiritual, because she said, okay, let's pray and fast for 3 days.
Okay, technically she didn't say let's pray. She said let's fast, but okay. I agree
let's
with
fast.
You.
They're going to do something more than fasting, though.
Yes, and actually, I mean... That is a main point of Esther. There's a lot of people in scholarship who want to say, oh, this is a secular book, and it was just, you know, theologized, and that's completely bogus. It's absolutely impossible, because the whole thing is just riddled with allusions to other places in the Bible. So, not...
It's only because the name of God is not there.
Exactly. And the point is, he went out of his way not to name God. That's the point, because exactly in passages like fasting... Sometimes we miss the fact that there's no prayer mentioned because it's so tied in our mind to prayer. But the Esther's author has, for his own reason, specifically avoided the use of God. And I think there's a very good reason for that.
Because he's playing on this theme of them having to hide their Judaism.
Yeah, there's a whole theme of secrecy in the book, definitely. And so you see this plain reading of the text, and it's just begging you to understand that there's more to it than that. You know, none of the laws of Persia can be changed. Really? And yet, you know, Haman says the exact same wording as Esther does, and they both get their way. And, you know, basically, Ahasuerus is this huge, grand king and controls everything. Oh, does he? You know, that's what the author is trying to get you to think about the whole time. And
there's a story of God obviously acting without ever really showing, without being obvious about it. Without
any supernatural break-in, and without stating it blatantly, exactly. So that's number one to get. So I definitely want to come back to this, what you're saying, I just want to flesh out and build on, because I think some of the connection to Saul actually helps us understand Esther's character more. So I wrote this down to say she's obedient as she starts out in the book, and reserved. Now, what can you tell me about Saul's character when we first meet Saul? For one, let's check, look at 1 Samuel 9, verses 3 and 4. Kind of leave one finger in 1 Samuel for a while.
And the donkeys of Kish, Saul's father, were lost, and Kish said to his son Paul, please take one of the servants with you and arise and go and look for the donkeys. So he passed through the mountains of Ephraim and through the land of Shalisha, but they did not find him. Then they passed through the land of Shalim, and they were not there. Then he passed through the land of Benjamin, but they did not find him.
Okay. So, sound like when you read that you said Paul. Funny. Just from my perspective. Okay, so Saul, the first thing we hear about him, really, is that he doesn't say anything. He's being obedient. His dad's asked him to go out and look for lost property, and so he does. And he does so very obediently. He's gone through several distances. And even in verse 5, he says to his servant, you know, let's go back before my dad quits worrying about the donkeys and starts to worry about us. So he's this very responsible, obedient son. Also, look forward a couple verses. Let's see what verses... Where, this is a funny one, yeah. Look at 1 Samuel 9, 11 to 13. Okay, so they're coming up into the town. They met some girls coming out to draw water. And they said to them, "Is this where the seer is?" Oh man, I wish. Does anyone mind if I read it in Hebrew?
Well, mine, we just won't understand.
Okay, well, look at verse 12. So they answer him, and they say, "Yes, here, right in front of you, quick. Now it's a day, go to the city, because there's this big sacrifice today, and everyone's at the Bama." So the impression you get in their answer is that they're all answering at once, right? They're all very excited to talk to this incredibly gorgeous person asking them for help. He, however, is quite reserved about it all, and he just gets his information and heads on. And if you notice, where are they? What?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I mean, what? They're coming up to a town, but what part of the town are they in? They found girls who were going out to
get water.
And what should that ding in your mind? What?
The well scenarios.
Well scenarios. What happens at wells?
People meet.
People meet people. People get engaged, right? Rebecca, Rachel, Tzipora.
Engaged in marriage and conversation.
Jesus didn't marry them.
That's true, but there is tension in that story. Anytime you hear a well, you think...
That's why they were upset at Jesus, and what are you doing?
Yeah, like, what in the world is going on? Exactly.
I googled where Luke is. It's like just out of the door.
There you go. Again, we're in the area of Benjamin. Jerusalem's on the border of Benjamin. So, you know, he could have stayed and flirted with all these nice girls. Well, maybe they're nice. But he didn't. In this case, he was very reserved and just kind of like, okay, thanks, and kept going on his way. And then, if you notice also, in 1 Samuel 10:16, we're skipping over the whole meeting with Samuel, where he gets anointed and all of that. You know, all that minor stuff. Notice in 1 Samuel 10:16 it says, "But Saul did not tell him what Samuel had said about the matter of kingship." Okay? So we have another parallel that they are reserved to the point of concealing their identity, or concealing major things that happen. So in the same way Esther doesn't tell her family background, Saul doesn't tell everything that happened in being anointed king. So they're quite, they have subtle characters. And they don't seem to be taking any initiative when we first meet them. Did we also look at Esther 20? Let's pop over there really quick. Esther 2:20. Oh, don't tell me that. Okay, so we have a double instruction. We read the first one already. Esther was not divulging her lineage or her people, just as Mordecai had instructed her. Esther continued to do whatever Mordecai said, just as she had done when he was raising her. So again, we have this emphasis on her being an obedient person, not given to bold, daring things or jumping out and giving extra information. And some people would say these characteristics, these are your only royalty in the Bible that are described this way, as being quite docile. and not full of super initiative. Now, the character shift does happen. We all know Esther becomes very brave. So let's look at that moment of change for her. Look at chapter 4 of Esther, verses 10 and 11. Who wants to read it?
Then she instructed him to say to Mordecai, "All the king's officials and the people of the royal provinces know that for any man or woman who approaches the king in the inner court without being summoned, the king has but one law, that he be put to death. The only exception to this is for the king to extend the golden scepter to him and spare his life. But 30 days have passed since I was called to go to the king."
Okay. And keep going.
When Esther's words were reported to Mordecai, he sent back this answer: "Do not think that before you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to royal position for such a time as this."
Okay. So these are very loaded words in his message. If you remain silent. So, the word we're looking at, haharesh taharishi, if you really remain silent. Keep that in your mind, and I want you to read 1 Samuel 10:27.
Said, "How can his fellow sailors, they despised him and brought him their gifts, but Saul kept silent."
Exactly. So Saul is being made fun of here. And you'd expect him to defend himself. But there he is, being silent. Same word, kemaharish. So I'll go ahead and... So Saul, in 1 Samuel 10, stays silent. Was that a good thing or a bad thing? I don't know. Sometimes character traits can be both. But we definitely know that Saul has this tendency to stay silent, to not take the initiative. And so Mordecai, when he's talking to Esther, is saying, don't be like Saul. If you stay silent, i.e. if you do what your family tends to do, relief and salvation are going to come from somewhere else. The other way he refers to her in Esther 4:10-11, look at what he says about her family. Says, "You and your father's house will perish," right? Mm-hmm. So if you look at 1 Samuel 9:20, "Whom does all Israel desire?" This is talking to, Samuel is talking to Saul here. "Whom does all Israel desire? Is it not you and all your father's house?" Yeah. And even in 9:21, we see Saul kind of making a little bit of an excuse. "Am I not a Benjamite from the smallest of Israel's tribes? And is not my family clan the smallest of all the tribes of Benjamin? Why do you speak to me in this way?" So you and your father's house. When Mordecai is saying that, he's definitely hinting that Esther is from Saul's family's house. And even if you take the words he used, they're very special words for relief and saving. And you could follow those if you think about the stories about Saul and David. Now, if any one detail stood on its own, it might be too small to make a connection. But when you have clusters of details like this, and you've already been drawn to parallels between the two, then it is very valid to start finding the details that link between the two.
It's like phrases from a movie that everyone recognizes as being from that specific movie, and then
you
keep using those.
Especially if it's a rare word, like revach, space, or relief. It's a rare word. And in fact, I think it's only, I can check for you now, I think it's only three times in the Bible. Or, no, there's a couple times in poetry. Let me just do that again really quick. I didn't write it down. Revach. Oh, it's gonna. Well, that would take too long. I have to tag it.
What's the word in Hebrew?
Revach?
Revach.
Revach.
Reshvavhet.
The same root as ruach, but a different word. Ruach is spirit. And if you look at 1 Samuel 16, the story about basically Saul's demise. And Saul, the Spirit of God leaves Saul. And instead, he has an evil spirit that torments him. If you read down, Saul says to his servant, I'm reading from verse 17, find me a man who plays well and bring him to me. And then one of his attendants replied, I've seen a son of Jesse in Bethlehem who knows how to play the lyre. He is a brave warrior and is articulate and handsome, for the Lord is with him. So you have this contrast of God being with David and Saul not having God with him. So they get David. And verse 23, so whenever the spirit from God would come upon Saul, David would take his lyre and play it. This would bring relief to Saul and make him feel better. Then the evil spirit would leave him alone.
And relief here is the same word, is it?
That's right.
Oh. I just wanted to point out, I've been involved for many years in what you might call right-wing activity for Israel. And the verse that comes out time and again, particularly at this time of the year, is 4:14. If you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. Mm-hmm. And who knows that you've come to your royal position for such a time as this. So always, whenever somebody's in a... It even becomes a prayer in many, many Jewish situations, that somebody, it could be the Prime Minister, it could be anybody, who suddenly finds himself in a place of authority at such a time as this, and this is the time that God has for them. And this gets repeated. I just wanted to point it out. I'm sure most people know that.
Yeah, so we have this here, by the way, veravach is a verb, and in Esther it's a noun. But the same relief, the noun that's related to the verb, it's the same. I don't know, how do you call it? Word. Extended word, maybe. But with all this paralleling to Saul, Israel's first king, I think there's also contrast to David. And David, by the way, the Hatzalah.
Sorry about that.
It's okay. If you read the story of David against the Amalekites, who I'll look at on Wednesday, he saves. He repeatedly says, and he saved, and he saved, and he saved. And so it's kind of contrasted. Saul gets gets partial saving if you look at, where's my verse here? Where it says he went out against the enemies all around. 1 Samuel 14:48. He does get a once he gets a saved, but that one saved is kind of contrasted with David's many savings. And so, again, you're thinking as you're reading through Esther about these two leaders in Israel's past. You have Saul and you have David. And what are you going to be like? And it's not just a simple question, because it's not necessarily one over the other in everything. It might be one trait of one and one trait of another. But it's an interesting idea if you're thinking about these things, because as you read Esther, a lot has been said about, you know, help will come from another place. And obviously this is one of the places that Esther's author could have brought in God if he wanted to. But he's consciously sidestepping that. But it might also be inferring another place, as in not your family line, somebody else's. As in, you know, you're from Saul's family, maybe it'll go back to David's family. Or that type of switching, which God does all the time. He puts someone in position, and if they don't follow him, he removes them from position, and he puts in someone else. And so none of us are, would you say, indispensable. That's a good word. So this all has an impact on Esther. And what does it do to her?
It causes her to call that fast and have the other people go on a fast with her.
Yeah.
And her just and
somehow she's woken up through this statement. And maybe in rethinking some of these connections. Like, yeah, do I really want to be like Saul?
And taking responsibility.
Do I really want to be so reticent or so silent that I fail to be obedient and show initiative where I should? And so there's this flip inside of her. And she fasts and presumably calls on God's help. And then we see a totally different Esther. And the rest of the book, there's nothing, she's still subtle, but there is nothing in her that lacks initiative. She very much takes initiative. In fact, she doesn't tell Mordecai what her plan is, right? She comes up with it. And she risks her life to go to the king. You know, if I perish, I perish. So that's kind of like the extreme initiative, you could say.
Just go back a minute, Sharon.
Mm-hmm.
The parallel between Saul goes off being, and he gets an evil spirit. The spirit of God leads him.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, what Mordecai is saying to Esther is the same principle. If you fail at this time, if you go off beam at this time, mm-hmm. don't worry. Somebody else will come in,
mm-hmm.
but you'll suffer. Your family will suffer. Whatever. I mean,
right.
Is that the right parallel? I mean, after all, it was David who came in and sort of. Took over the ball. Something did come. I mean,
yeah,
you say it's
yeah,
God,
yeah.
But it doesn't say here it's God. It says it was David who came in and rescued the situation.
Right.
And here you've got the situation is that Esther is actually doing the opposite. She's picking up the ball herself and saying, right.
Well, she needs to pick up the ball. In a sense, I think one of the things Esther is trying to tell you is God is working behind the scenes.
Right.
Definitely. But don't think that you can just do nothing then.
Right.
You also have to do your part.
Right.
Because if you don't, God's going to find someone else who will.
Right.
In the same way that Saul, I mean, why was he kicked out of kingship?
He let his troops take the animals from the Amalekites.
Well, right? Lots of reasons. He also goes and tries to raise them.
Well, he spared Agag, who's the king of Amalek. Uh-huh. But why was that bad?
Because he'd been told to kick, didn't he?
Because he didn't obey.
Because he didn't obey, very simply. God had given specific instructions, kill everyone, and he didn't do it. And he came up with very good reasons for not doing it. Oh, I was going to make you this big, huge sacrifice. You know, he rationalized it very well. But in the end, that's where Samuel says, isn't obedience better than sacrifice? So the ultimate characteristic that God's looking for is obedience. And if you're not going to do it, he's going to find someone else who will. And that definitely spoke to Esther.
There's an interesting thing with Esther, too, that she's there's initiative, but there's also improvising, too. Mm-hmm. Like, there's it's seemingly so much easier with Saul. One, he doesn't have anything at stake, really. Like, it's not like, there's no sword of Damocles on his neck.
Like, I mean, he's in the upper position because he's already king.
I mean, if he messes up, he's still king. There's no, you know, he can...
Or so he thinks, yeah,
right.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I mean, he does mess up many times, and he gets second chances. She only has one chance to mess up, really.
Right.
And then everything is lost. So she has so much more at stake. And then also, she's had God... I mean, he's had God give him specific instructions, like you said, and she has no instructions. She's
right.
Having to wing it. She's having to come up with her own, to figure it out herself.
Figure it out, right. And I mean,
and hope that God's helping her out.
And even her trials are kind of a reverse of Saul's. She calls a fast, Saul takes more animals. Saul spares the king. She confronts the king.
Mm-hmm.
Her whole power is she has an inspired speech, just like Saul does after he's anointed.
Uh-huh.
It's kind of a
yeah. There are many parallels, definitely. And the other parallel in the Saul David stories, in the middle of the two times that Saul spares his life, David, there's a story of David and Abigail in the middle, and so it's kind of like a series of how do you deal with revenge? And like David never touches Saul because you're the anointed of God and God's going to get revenge for me. I don't need to. So that's sandwiched. But then in between, there's a story where David almost loses it and takes his own revenge. That's the whole story with Abigail. And there's actually a lot of, we don't have time to go into it right now, a lot of verbal links from our Esther story go back to that story as well. So Abigail and again, these whole leaders, Saul's leadership and David's leadership, are definitely behind the telling of Esther. And in some cases, Saul's a character foil. But then also, maybe there's a little bit of critique of David as well. Because at the end of David's life, he did actually take revenge. He just told his son to take revenge. I couldn't do it. I'm bound by oath, but you know what to do.
Yeah, if you hire a hitman, that's the same.
I don't remember the story of Abigail. Can we do it in three lines?
Abigail, married to a really rich guy who's shearing sheep. They're about to have a big, huge party and tons of food. And David's been out in the desert taking care of those people. And so he asks for a little bit of the party, provisions for his men. Nabal basically says, who are you? I don't have to listen to you because you're on your way out, kind of thing. And David gets very offended and his vows to wipe out everyone in his family. Abigail hears about it and so goes in secret, brings him a bunch of provisions and gives a very flattering, elaborate speech and saves her family, which is similar to Esther because Esther isn't just saving her family, she's saving a whole nation. And it's interesting if you parallel who in Esther, it's always saving her whole nation against the enemies, where within the David and Solomon, some of these other stories, there's internal strife going on. You're getting back in your brother, like between Saul and David. They're Benjamin and Judah. You're internally fighting.
Civil war.
Where you should be getting vengeance on your enemies, not on your brother. And so some of those themes, I think, are also woven in Esther, where Esther is putting right what should have happened before. Yeah.
Is it also worth pointing out for the connections to Saul's story that Haman is an Agagite, a descendant of...
Oh, well, for sure.
...that he didn't kill?
For sure.
Right, didn't kill him.
He didn't kill him. That was part of his disobedience.
Yeah.
And because of that, Haman comes. And if you want to follow the Saul connection, notice that Saul, when he dies, and his three sons were hung, right? Or they were skewered, actually. And the same thing happens. Haman and his sons get skewered. But how many sons does Haman have?
Seven.
No. How many? Come on. We read them through the scroll. You know, there's a tradition you try to read it through with one breath. It's almost impossible because there's all these Persian names that are... Blah, blah, blah.
Ten.
Exactly. Ten. So where are the other seven? If you look at story of the Gibeonites, where they request to kill off basically Saul's remaining kin, and they end up killing seven of Saul's relatives. So you have three initially and seven, and they hang them up the same way. So 10 of Saul's descendants then get hung. And now that's going to be paralleled by Haman and his sons being hung up. So yeah, there's plenty. And John, I don't know if you were here from the very beginning, but I was saying how we're going to talk specifically about the Amalek link on Wednesday night at Christ Church. Okay.
We can't come next time.
Sure, we'll do it. I mean, it's one of the most, I don't know, the most obvious in some senses, because it mentions Agagi, which goes back to Agag, the first king of Amalek. And so the disobedience that Saul left undone, Esther, who is basically from Saul's line but better, is going to undo and do it right. And so we can look at that.
What were you planning to do next week?
Well, there's so many other links. There's also, we didn't even get to the Abigail story. There's also parallels to Solomon's reign. And there's parallels to the Joseph story that are quite big. And I think that also goes back to, who are Rachel's children? Tell me, Rachel's. Joseph and Benjamin. Right. And Joseph's son, I mean, Ephraim becomes the big tribe that's identified with Joseph. And that to me leads back to Amalek, because Joshua is commander of the army and he is from Ephraim. And so within Jewish tradition, they comment, Amalek's only beaten when Rachel's descendants get involved in the battle. So that's another link to Amalek. But okay, we'll do Amalek next week then if you want. So what you can do in the meantime, because our service downstairs is about to start, make sure you read through Esther, because there are things that you will see there that you haven't seen before, especially if you're... The last time you read through the book was when you were little. But that way next week when we start just grabbing out details here and there, it'll be fitting into a bigger picture. Because if we read the whole book together this morning, it will take all our time, and then we can't draw the parallels.
As we wear silly hats next week.
Yeah, and wear silly hats.
As a parent, this is a really good picture of also what we hold for our children, who end up being at first, they're obedient and they're learning how to make decisions, but then when it comes to whoever meets the road, that they would react like Queen Esther and be able to...
And we didn't go back and follow out that thing in Saul, but Saul also has that pivotal moment. The Spirit of God falls on him, and all of a sudden he becomes very brave.
It says his character was changed.
Yeah, just completely. And I think this is very true. Like some of us, the apostles, for one, like everyone's off hiding after Jesus dies and no one knows what to do. And then they're all filled with the Spirit and all of a sudden, bam, let's go tell the world. And there's a bravery there that that you just see is miraculous, really.
May that happen to us.
Amen. So with that, we'll say Shabbat Shalom.